little bit about chukas, and let's see. Okay, I want to talk about two things about chukas, and we'll see if it slips in Zimbabwe. One is my favorite satire. My favorite satire ever is obviously Rav Lichtenstein's satire, which I'll tell you about in a moment. But of course, the most famous satire, which is my second favorite, actually my third, because the Gemara comes first. The most famous satire in world literature is, of course, Jonathan Swift, who wrote A Modest Proposal. And what makes a satire so powerful is that there are two layers of meaning, and you have to be taken by the integrity and the consistency of the top layer, so you really think it's serious, not just a joke. Sarcasm or cynicism, you're just joking about everything. Satire is you're deadly serious about something, and then you draw people into your lair because they're really following because this is a serious presentation, and then you sting them with one thing they got wrong. Then you realize that everything they've thought is prejudicial and vapid and vacant. So in Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal, he was writing a proposal to solve the problem of Irish poverty in the 18th century British persecution. So he's writing a proposal how to deal with the Irish issue, and of course, this is that. And he's proposing it to the Parliament of Britain. And he writes, going through the whole process, delineating the issues and the negligence of the Irish population. And then his conclusion is, and every Englishman will get to eat two or three Irish babies per month for a weekend. It just it seems so serious until it becomes obscene and bizarre. And it just shows you how bizarre the entire treatment, at least from the Irish perspective, was on the hands of the British. Not just in America, the racial tension. So that's the most famous satire. I'll get to the satire in this week's parsha in a moment. But Rav Lichtenstein used to give fantastic satires. He would give Musar Shmuz through satire. So, for example, I think it was one night we came in Friday night and no one was singing Shalom Aleichem properly. So instead of lambasting us, he launched on the spot into a 40-minute shiur detailing the various minhagim of Shalom Aleichem. Some people say it three times. Some people say it once. Some people don't say Barachem, Barachim L'Shalom. Some say it's Seischel L'Shalom, Malachim, Christianity. The entire process, and we're sitting there with our tongue. We're starving. We can't wait to eat. He's going on and on and on talking about Shalom Aleichem. And then his conclusion is, but the boys of this yeshiva, they're great tzaddikim. They're big tzaddikim. They want to be machmir like all the shittos. We're saying, where's he going with this? He says, to be machmir fi al shittos, they don't sing Shalom Aleichem at all. And of course, he stung us because we weren't avoiding Shalom Aleichem because we knew anything that he was talking about or that we had any inkling about the shittos or that we wanted to be machmir. We weren't singing Shalom Aleichem because we were lazy. And he said, now start singing. And we all started screaming Shalom Aleichem. You couldn't hear yourself. It was screaming. But the best satire that Rav Lichtenstein ever gave was around 1987. I have to set it up for you. In the early 80s, life in Gush was like living in a third world country. When you see documentaries on public broadcasting stations about starving children in Africa, we were on those documentaries. When they ran out of reels from children in Africa, they'd come to Gush and just take pictures. Oh, we were starving. There's no makolet, no restaurants. I mean, makolet here with a couple of frozen chickens. We were starving our heads off. And you walked into the kitchen, you walked into the dining room for lunch, and you sat down at a table. It wasn't self-serve. The food was put into tureens. And there was eight to a table, and there were about eight portions on the table. Eight drumsticks, eight portions of canned meat. That was what we were eating that day. Eight little portions of rice, and that's it. There's no one there. You sat down, and you ate. Guys, get ready. That's what it's going to be like when you come back. You get these little chamgashin, and there's a lot of them, so you get to eat doubles and triples. But it's not like you're walking up and put your fingers into the rice. That's the Corona rice. We don't have Corona rice here. You get your little chamgash and you eat, because you won't be hungry. Don't worry. You won't be hungry. Anyway, so what happened was, and all of a sudden, somehow the yeshiva got some more money, and the yeshiva realized that if they served cafeteria style, it would be cheaper, and they could, guys would eat double. So we were just raving mad. We were lunatics. What, extra rice? People couldn't wrap our heads around it. Doubles and soup. As much corn as you want, to your heart's delight. These were like otherworldly experiences for us. We were drunk for the first week. So what happened was people would just like make mad stampedes into the lunchroom. Maybe they're going to pull it away. Like we just didn't believe it. Maybe this is just temporary. And we'd be waiting online for 15 minutes to get into lunch because we couldn't believe this would last. That's how hungry we were. Now, of course, if there's one thing that drove Rav Lichtenstein batty, it was people waiting for lunch. I mean, as far as he's concerned, he should be eating lunch at 1:29, maybe, every other day on a rotational basis, you know, like gas rationing. So you eat lunch based on whether your last name starts with the A to F or G to P every other day at 1:29. The notion that boys would stand outside waiting for food at the cost of Bittul Torah for morning Seder was just abominable to Rav Aaron. So we called the Sichas Musar at 12:45, which part of the Sichas Musar at 12:45 was it lasted till 1:35. So that was part of the Musar that just we didn't get to eat that day so well. And he was talking about how he heard from Bensi, who used to be the cook, that there were boys who were waiting online and charging into the kitchen. And he heard that one boy hurt his leg, which I think happened, like a boy that got crushed. That's how bad it was. He said, it reminds me of the mission in Yoma where the Kohanim are running up to the Mizbeach. And the Kohanim, they were saying, Rebbe, this has nothing to do with Yoma. Those Kohanim wouldn't have other. These people are just greedy, hungry 18-year-old. But he's like going through this whole thing. And the whole place, the entire base matters is cracking up because they realize that he's tongue-in-cheeking it. But I'm sitting in the front row, literally center seat, I can feel his breath on me. Like it wasn't good for Corona, but I'm right there. And I'm trying my hardest to keep a straight face because I'm not going to ruin his satire because the whole point of his satire has to be seemingly serious. I'm sitting there, like, pinching myself, not laughing. The place is rolling. And then he said he heard that there are some tzaddikim in yeshiva who realized the crush and the stampede at 1 o'clock. So they've taken, voluntarily, they've taken their Torah time and they've been mevatel Torah l'shem shamayim and they're waiting early so they can get in to avoid the crush. He said, can you imagine such tzifus? He launched a whole medrash about the problems of bittul Torah. A person gets to shamayim, you have to face a cheshbon and nefesh. Could you imagine the tzifus of these boys? And they're willing to face such oynesh and shamayim just the tzarchei tzibor to ease the rush. Like, everyone that pays matters just rolling, belly laughing. Rebbe, believe me, that's so they just want lunch. And he's going on and I'm sitting, holding my breath. I'm not going to ruin his satire. And then he says something and I just lose it. He says, in his deep, moral, guttural voice, he says, and these boys, they're not just tzaddikim. They're also tznuim. The Gemara in Bava Kama, that's the ultimate tzidkos only is a tznuah. There used to be mafres trumos at Aniyim Tuch, just in case the Aniyim, it's all Gemara in Bava Kama. People are not just tzaddikim, but they're modest, and they don't want people to know they're tzaddikim. He says, you'd think that after wasting so much time for bittul Torah l'shem shamayim, they'd eat lunch as quickly as they can and run back to the base matters and make up the time. Tashlumin. Such tzaddikim, they don't want people to know who they are. So after they finish lunch, they run to their rooms and they hide until mincha, so no one should know who they are. And at that point, I couldn't keep it anymore. Rabbi, they're not snooing. They're not running back to their room to hide. And I start laughing. I just can't hold myself in. And he lost it. Like he was sitting right in front of me and he saw me cracking up. He started cracking. These are such good satires. So anyway, what's the satire in Parshas Chukas? What comes about in Parshas Chukas? So in Parshas Chukas, let me find you the psukim. In Parshas Chukas, let me find Yomu HaMoshlim. Let me find a word that I can pull it up for you. The great wars are discussed. It's not going to be able to find it on the pasuk. The great wars between Sichon Melech HaMori and Midyan are discussed. Now, to a degree, these wars are necessary for us to know about because there's a lot hinging upon these wars. Moab is a descendant of Lot. The Jews are not allowed to provoke Moab. But Amori, they're pagans. So these lands that Moab had owned, if Sichon will succeed in conquering these lands, then these lands are now available for Jewish conquest in the event of war. If Moab triumphs, then these lands are off limits. So the conclusion or the eventuality of this war is really critical to the ensuing parshiyos, B'nai Gad, B'nai Reuven, Chatzin Shevet, Menashe. It's really important to know whether Sichon triumphs or Moav triumphs. And wouldn't you know, Sichon Melech Amori triumphs, and then we triumph over Sichon, and we secure these lands in Avar Hanar, Avar HaYarden on the East Bank, not the West Bank, the East Bank. In general, the environment is that the Jews are coming to Israel, and history is waking up. It's a very sleepy place, Canaan. Nothing really is happening until B'tzeis Yisrael Minasayim, and everything, all of a sudden, everyone's getting to the action. Emori, Ogmel, Chabashan, Moab, Midjan, Balak, Bilam, Amalek, Canaan. Everyone just, because when the Jews are returning to Israel, history starts to shimmy. History starts to shake because it's a historically eventful and resonant event when Jews return to Israel. Shem Wamim, Yirgazim, everyone starts to get a little uptight. Because, you know, we're not settling Iceland. It's not like a couple of Icelanders moved to Iceland. It's a different field. But there's a specific interest, who will victor? Okay. But if you read the Psukim, it's almost, satiric? I mean, it's disproportionate. It's absurd almost. So let's look at the Psukim. Starting with Chav Zayin. Al Kane, it's on the screen. Yom Ramoshlim Bo Cheshbon. All the leaders gathered in Cheshbon. Cheshbon was the metropolis of Moab, which was lost to Sichon Melech Amori in the battle. So Cheshbon was the sent to the battlefield, but that was like their capital, which was surrendered to Sichon. So all the diplomats and generals gather in Cheshbon, either before the war to negotiate a peace, after the war to negotiate the settlement, to draw the new maps. But there's a lot of activities, like the Versailles. Everyone's in Versailles. So they're in Cheshbon. Tibonev v'tikonein ir Sichon. Seems like it's actually happening after the war. Sichon has triumphed. Now the city of Cheshbon should be established and designated as a city of Sichon, because Sichon has triumphed and Moab surrenders it to Sichon. Okay? Now listen to this. Ki esh yatsa mi Cheshbon. A fire erupted from Cheshbon. Lehava, flame, mikiryat Sichon. Achla ar Moav. And it consumed. Ar is either a city or the name of city Bale Bamos Arnon, the people who lived on the cliffs, the highlanders of Arnon. Anyone know where Arnon is? Why are we interested in the highlanders? Who cares about the diplomatic activity in Cheshbon? This is TMI. It's a little too much information for our purposes. We need to know who wins the war, not the details of the diplomacy. And then it gets even more absurd. Has anyone ever read Homer or other Greek bards who spoke about war and heroics in war? You're going to hear psukim that sound very similar. Of course, the bards got it from Tanakh, but Oy lecha Moav, woe is to you, Moav. That's exactly how bards would speak. Woe is to you, Sparta. You've lost your children. Your daughters are now captivity. This is exactly, not taken from bards, but it's exactly language songs about war. Oy lecha Moav, woe is to you, Moav, the losers. Avadata am Kemosh, you lost Kemosh. Nasan banav pleitim, your children are refugees. Uven otav bashvit, and your daughters are in captivity. Lemelech hamori. If you look at the next pasuk, I think I don't know the next pasuk here, but vaniram avarad meshuram. Let me see if I can pull it up here. If you look at the next pasuk, vaniram avad cheshbon, and you lost cheshbon, adivon, vanashim ad novach. In machlokas, whether these are names of places or actual descriptions of land losses, but you're talking about extra psukim. Remember, we've got entire mesechtos. I told the boys today, we're giving Shiron Yesh Nochel and Shiron Baloni, right? He spent 2 weeks on the word matana, la seslo, 2 weeks on the word leichal levaker, 2 weeks on the word yakir, 2 weeks on the word imatzei. So every word in Kitetze is carefully, carefully contoured. And here you've got psukim upon psukim of irrelevant information about cities that we don't know about nor care about. Niram, Divon, Nashim, Nofach, Medva. So this is inviting a satire. And the satire, believe it or not, is in Bava Basra. So that's a nice Bava Basra tie-in. If you look at Bava Basra, Ayin Ches Amud Aleph. It's on your screen. I have most of the Gemara here. It's a really important satire. And I hope that when I say it, you say, oh, I've heard that from Rabbi Karagin before, but it's a good reminder. Not necessarily this Gemara, but the general theme. Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Mai dechtiv al kein yomu hamoshlim bo cheshbon. Hamoshlim, they're not the diplomats. They're not the generals. They're not the politicians. Elu hamoshlim biyitzram. people of moral strength and conviction. The pasuk seems to be talking about diplomats, and the style seems to be heroic, people that accomplish heroic things. But what's the real heroism? Quiet, moral courage. Bo Cheshbon. Cheshbon isn't the name of a city that we don't care about. Cheshbon is the experience they're engaging in. Cheshbon HaNefesh. Bo V'Nachashev Cheshbono Shel Olam. The calculus, the algebra of the world. What's the algebra of the world? Not politics, not wars, not diplomacy. Morality. Hefseid mitzvah, line 3, keneged schar. Every mitzvah carries a price. You could be relaxing. You could be making some money. You could be escaping a difficult predicament by lying. You could be gaining. Every mitzvah has a price. But every mitzvah has a schar, so you have to weigh the two. There's no freebies. Schar aver keneged hefseid. Every aver has a schar. Whatever enjoyment you need, whatever release you're seeking, whatever escapism, there's always a schar to an aver, but there's a great hefseid, and you've got to calculate. Tiboneh v'tikonein, Ir Sichon, doesn't mean the city of Cheshbon will be built. The city of Cheshbon has long been wiped off the map. Imata osekein, if you are a person of great moral courage and you're Moshe b'Yitzro, and you engage in a cheshbon nefesh to steady your religious experience, then the city that you will reinforce is not the city of Cheshbon, but the city that Cheshbon produces, the city in this world and the city in heaven. You see the flip? To the naked eye, the pasuk is talking about politicians who gather in Cheshbon and talk about diplomacy and headlines. But Rabbi Yochanan is saying, no. If that were true, Tara isn't interested in that. Tara is living a moral message that, though it may seem that way if you read the text, and you just look at the headlines, you don't see morally heroic people in headlines, just like you don't see them in the Pesukim and Chukas. They're concealed. But they're the real Moshlim, and they're the real Cheshbon, and they're the real founders of cities. History, and when you're young, you think it's, history is not really shaped by the events that most people pay attention to. They seem to impact in the short term, and they do impact in the short term, but in the long term, it's cyclical, and it balances out, and it offsets, and it, whatever Obama legislates, Trump will rescind, whatever Trump legislated, I'm sure. And even if it lasts 50 years, 100 years, these are all human monuments. And human monuments fade in the sands of time. Real influence in human experience are quiet moral decisions, when I say moral religious as well, for religious people, that shape people's lives in a very deep way that no one really knows about. And it's that energy that shapes the world. It's heroism in a quiet sense, sticking to your guns, to your principles, sacrificing for them, modeling them to others, making decisions based on them, wanting to pay prices for them. This Gemara is actually inserted by the Mesilas Yesharim in his Hakdama to the Mesilas Yesharim. This is the Ramchal quotes this Gemara in general to highlight the importance of a morally sound life, but in particular to highlight Cheshbon HaNefesh. It's interesting. I don't think Cheshbon HaNefesh is so popular in our day. I remember there was a boy in high school who was a year or two ahead of me. I was very, very influenced by him. Unfortunately, he died of cancer at a very, very young age. I think when it was either high school or maybe my first year out of high school. And I have very fond memories of him. And he once told me, he would speak to me a little bit. I had a very, very tumultuous high school, put it this way. It wasn't as if I had very sharpened moral clarity, but there were a couple of voices that really steadied me, that I really latched onto. One of them is currently a Rosh Yeshiva in Neri Yisrael. The Rosh Yeshiva, so I spoke to him the other night. But a couple of voices who came into my world, and they gave me the sense that there was a different world that I could be part of. There was a, grew up in a very, very confusing moral place in Brooklyn, and it's just a lot. Without getting into the details, in a yeshivish environment that really didn't fit me, a lot of swirl, a lot of confusion. But I'm saying this to you, because you're at an age now where you may be able to play that role for someone. All of a sudden, if you know a younger sibling or a younger person or a younger family member, And just, again, you don't have to all of a sudden become their swami and revolutionize their world and lobotomize them. Now, of course, tell them to come to Krishna. But I mean, but seriously, if you just have a little bit of contact, all of a sudden, they may not revolutionize their lives, but you'd be surprised about the hope you give them. Okay, when I grow up and I leave high school, I'll find a place, I'll find a world which is more functional than maybe the world kids sometimes find themselves in high school. Anyway, so this person told me that he conducted a cheshbon ha-nefesh every night. He put his head down on the bed and he would sit there and think about what he did well and what he didn't do so well. And I was very taken by that because it seemed very intense. I actually bought myself a little spiral notebook, one of those small spirals. You guys don't even know what they are. And a small little spiral notebook, I still remember it. And I drew a line right in the middle of each little small page, good and bad. It was very comical because my mother found it a couple months ago and she sent it to me like, I poured ketchup for my father and I let my brother have extra mustard and just gave him my French fries. It was like a 13. I don't know how old I was. And then I stopped it, but I'm not sure if our world would allow constant daily cheshbon ha-nefesh, but every once in a while, I try sometimes on Shabbos to think about certain parts of my week that went well, certain parts of my week that didn't go well, because we just leave it to the ever-flowing ebb and flow, especially when we get out of Corona. One of the interesting parts about Corona is I was in the supermarket. I just came back from the supermarket. I spent a lot of time in the supermarket. Put it this way, I do a lot of shopping. In the supermarket, I think last Thursday, a lot of kids are home now, so it's just we've turned into Costco. We do a lot of food in this house. So I was in the supermarket, and I bumped into Ben Tara. He's a psychologist in the area. I was in one of the Yishuvim. And I said to him, you must be really busy after the corona process, because my daughter is a psychologist in a different sector. She told me that, as you know, it's well documented, corona has amplified a lot of the psychological stress that people are exposed to, families, abuse, chas v'shalom. I just assumed that everyone's just really busy dealing with all the carnage, psychological and emotional toll of corona. So he looks at me a little bit sad. He says, actually, things have been pretty slow. And obviously, from a financial standpoint, it was. And I said, well, that's interesting. Why would you say so? He says, at least the clientele that he deals with, a lot of them have told him that the corona experience was just a lot slower. And they didn't feel the need to keep up with the pace that was maddening and frantic. And the slower pace alleviated some of the stress and the tension they were feeling under normal routine that caused them to require therapeutic attention and psychological care. And I'm not sure if we'll be able to carry that into our post-corona world. How do you slow things down? Things move so quick. I feel like I'm working very hard now as a person, but life is still much slower. It's a strange feeling. I'm under a lot of pressure, but I don't feel like the pace is as exacting and demanding. So anyways, this is a Gemara I felt like I really wanted to share with you. It's something I've talked about in the past. I think a lot of people in our world get very attracted to the high-profile world of popularity. And I've thought a lot to myself that there are three types of places people could look to for approval. Ideally, you should be able to look in the mirror and be proud of the person looking back out at you. And you have to learn how to make decisions to say, well, I can look in the mirror and no one else is looking at me and no one else is looking back at me. It's just me and my mirror, and who am I looking at? Am I looking at someone that makes proper decisions, is caring, is selfless? All the answers to that question. I think a lot of people have a hard time looking in the mirror. So you try to look at other things. So for some people, looking at screens is a nice diversion from looking at mirror. You know, you have to look at yourself. You can just look at a lot of other information and images on screens. A lot of people like looking at people looking at them. And that's also, even if it's not screens, just popularity and interest and how many likes do you get. And especially as I think a lot of boys in our yeshiva, and I talked about this last week with Karach, are very ambitious and you'll be very successful and there's a shem when you apply yourself. Just learn not to get intoxicated by it as best as you can, not to care about it, to be internal rather than external, to realize and appreciate people, let's say, that aren't involved in the front lines and their names aren't registered in newspapers. It's just living solid lives, family lives, and not to disdain people who are very involved in large formulas have a disdain for people that just, you know, sitting aside and raise their family. It's just a lot of that has to disappear, and this Gemara is a really good corrective and a really good balancer. Okay, let's shift a little bit to Balak. Again, I planned for Balak. I have shifted back to Chukas. Let's see if we can just talk a little bit about Balak. I'm going to pull out a sheet for Balak just for a second if I can. Sometimes you have these moments, and I've talked about them before, where you just want to ask the person, what were you thinking? My what were you thinking moment was, again, I've talked about this before, was when Bill Clinton was caught in the Oval Office. And I just would want to ask you, like, what high school intern, summer fling, leader of the free world, you're going to go down possibly as one of the top presidents in history, because he really was a very popular and successful president. And basically, he's a punchline. Going from being not Rushmore to a punchline. No one will ever, history will never. I mean, the two presidents that history will laugh at in different ways are Trump, obviously. Again, I want to be very clear on this. You can agree with his policies. You can agree even with his values in terms of abortion. I mean, on a personal level, I mean, the level of corruption and incompetence, you know, successful empires can withstand incompetent leaders. Okay, incompetent leaders will take the empire down a couple rats in the matches. Successful empires can handle greedy leaders, corrupt leaders. I think some of the leadership in Israel may be corrupt. But you can't have leaders that are both corrupt and incompetent. That's poison pill. That will completely erode. It eroded Rome, and it's, sadly, unless it's corrected, it's going to erode the United States. You can't have both. You can have leadership that's very competent and greedy. Putin is a very competent leader. He's probably greedy. He's probably corrupt, but seems to be competent. He's running Russia. Now, you can have incompetent leadership as long as they're well-intending and interested and selfless. Once you put that cocktail together, it's an explosion. So I was going to ask Clinton, what were you thinking? What were you saying to yourself? And I think that same question should be posed to Bilam. Bilam wasn't an idiot. I talked last week about Korach. Korach was a sage. Korach was a prince. Korach was a leader. Bilam's a prophet. And he's well-rounded. He's not some country bumpkin mouse. I mean, Eliezer, he doesn't live in Boston. Just had to get that in, right? He lives in Midyard. He's bohemian. He's cosmopolitan. He lives in Calgary. Right? He lives with all... Come on, what's he thinking? As we were saying in the Yeshiva Veld, what's his half of me? What's Bilam's half of me? He knows the score. You get the sense that a malek, they can't help themselves. The pirates, they're foaming and frothing with hatred for the Jews, defending their grandfather Esav. Bilam's thoughtful. Bilam is a prophet. Okay, there's a greed. There's a greed and arrogance that blinds him. It's part of the story. But there's something a little bit deeper. And that something deeper comes from a pasuk, and Chazal amplified the pasuk in a very interesting association. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah. So, in the very, very beginning, okay, remember there are three stages, there are different stages to his nevuah, but in the very beginning he says, Mima na afar ya'ako, I'm sorry, the pasuk before, ma'akov lo kabo kel, okay, I forgot. I didn't solve this since last week. Let's all log off and log back on. I still haven't forgot that we had a 40-minute limit. Let's all log off again. We'll take another 10, 15 minutes, not a lot. Okay, so I'm going to log off now, and then we'll all log on to the very same. I'll send it again if you need it. Okay, everyone, sorry about that. Let's continue. So just to cut to the chase, Ki Merosh Surim Erenu. I look at them from the tops of cliffs. Umiki va'ot ashureno. And I glance at them from apexes, from zeniths, tops of mountains. Hey, nam lebadad yishkonu v'avim lo yischashav. Very, very resonant pasuk. Very important pasuk. Chazal take this very seriously. Ksiv ki me'rosh tsirim erenu, who is hateful of them, and he wanted to try to find their flaws. That's the first shot in the Medrash. But the second shot of the Medrash, Davar Acher, look at the highlighted. Ki merosh tzer mer enro means, I want to look at their roots. Elu avos. Omigvaos elu imos. I want to go back to the genesis of this people. So Bilam isn't just this freight train off the rails with hatred. He's processing the origin of the Jewish people, the history of the Jewish people, the founding fathers of the Jewish people. And he feels that he has an in. What's his in? Let me put it to you this way. In some ways, Bilam is the first Christian. What do I mean he's the first Christian? He obviously isn't the theological Christian, but he's the first person to lodge the claim which ultimately Christianity would popularize and Islam would, of course, adopt. I'm just finding something wrong with my computer here for a second. Here we go. Okay. Bilam understands the Jewish narrative. He understands that the Jews were chosen. He understands Avraham, and that's why there's a lot of silhouetting between Bilam and Avraham in this week's Parsha. Very famous Mishnah, you can take a look here at the screen I'm sharing. Call me, Sheesh Bo, Gimel Dvaram Halelami Talmidav Shal Avraham Avinu, Gimel Dvaram Halelami Talmidav Shal Bilam. All of a sudden, Chazal want to compare and contrast Avraham and Bilam, not just in their moral behavior, but in their getting up early and saddling their own donkey, Vayashkim Avram Baboker to the Akedah, Vayakam Bilam Baboker. Chazal say Avram, his passion overcame his ration. He was so excited about the Akedah, he saddled his own donkey. In Bilam's case, his anger overcame his ration. Because Bilam is thinking about Avram. Bilam is not just looking at this nation, thinking strategically, geopolitically, militarily, how I defeat them. He's thinking about the history of the Jews and how to defeat them. And Bilam's claim is that the Jews were chosen, but they forfeited that selection because they sinned and because they betrayed their God by worshiping a golden calf and by disdaining their land. And that's the great Christian claim, that we were the chosen people, but God cast us aside after failing him twice during those two temples, and that God chose another people. And that's exactly Bilam's chiddush. That's why he's thinking about the avos. And again, I'm sure you know it, but just in case you don't, we'll just sink in. Chukas and Balak take place 40 years after Shlach and Korach. You don't see it because the Torah never makes an announcement. Oh, by the way, 40 years have passed. The way the Rav would say, the way the Torah literally conveys the passage of time, the 38 years, what happened during those 38 years? Nothing but death. So that's why the beginning of Chukas talks about death. It's a literary device to convey that 38 years have passed. Like you're watching a movie and they want to convey that year has passed, and you see the calendar flipping or the clock spinning or the sun rising and setting. This is the Torah's way of saying 38 years, death, 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 death. Oh, now let's continue. And if you're the average bystander, you're just assuming, yes, it's true. They're sinners. And God has neglected them in the desert. And now I could just defeat them like any other nation. And the takeaway of Parshas Balak is that Hashem chose us. And he will never cast us aside. And no matter how often we fail, the love that was established between Hashem and his people is unbreakable. And Bilam learns that lesson. And he articulates that lesson with several psukim. Ma ekov lo kabo el, which literally means, who shall I curse if Hashem doesn't curse him? Because I have no power, I have no authority. What does the Medrash say? Binoeg sheba olam, typically Bilam says, Legion Shemarad Bemelech, a legion of the king that rebels, they're executed. The Elu and these people, Kafrubo, they betrayed him. They rebelled. Elu Lacha Yisrael. Lo Tzarech Lechalosam, they should have been destroyed. afilu b'yonza shah lo zaz. He's like, my kovlok aboke, I can't do anything. They're still chosen. The literal meaning, my kovlok aboke, is I don't have any authority because Hashem determines who I'll curse and who I won't curse. Chazal invert this meaning. My kovlok aboke means I thought I could undercut them because they betrayed God and now God will curse them. They'll be a cursed people. And I can't curse them. He just loves them. And that bond is unbreakable. And so many of the psukim that Bilam voices, Chazal interpret that way. Lo hibit aven b'Yaakov, lo rama b'Yisrael. Very famous pasuk. We recite this in Rosh Hashanah. Hashem sees no fault, no evil, no toil. How do Chazal interpret this? Again, Bilam is shocked. He's learning b'chiras am Yisrael. That it's unbreakable. Amar Bilam. This is all Midrashim. Beautiful Midrashim. It's incredible. They've got oven, they've got ammo, and he doesn't care. Lo, he bit oven be Yaakov, velo ramo be Yisrael. All he does is think about their relationship and the love. And slowly but surely it's sinking into Bilam. This isn't going anywhere. This isn't going to land good for me. Because my whole strategy is basically flawed. Because my whole strategy is predicated on the fact that they have betrayed, they have oven, they have amal, they've said, Erecha Yisrael, they'll be cursed, and I'm just the icing on the cake. I'll just exploit that. Bilam talks about the fact that they are like a lion that goes to sleep. Kara, Ravatz, Shachav Kari, Uchalavi, Miyakimana. Like a lion that crouches and then wakes up. It's actually an interesting pasuk. The Gemara in Brachos, source number 10, says that this is part of the reason that there was a Havamina, a very, very monumental, faithful Havamina, that Kriya Shema should be composed of Shema, V'hayim Shema, and the third parsha, there's nothing that says that third parsha has to be tzitzis. It could be any parsha in the Torah that contains a reference to tzitzis Mitzrayim, because the money shot, the key sentence of the third parsha is Mitzrayim. It could have been any parshas. And the Gemara says, well, maybe let's insert parshas Bilam. Because Bilam says twice, Kel Motziam in Mitzrayim. That would make davening pretty long. Next time you're waiting for the Rav and Shul to finish Kriya Shema, not that you're waiting, because of course you're having such kavana that kavana love us alone, you're not thinking about it, but your friend's waiting for the Rosh Hashiva to finish Kriya Shema. Oh my goodness, it's taking a long time. Just imagine what Shema would be like if you had to read all of Bilam, because it's one long parsha, there's no break, which is what the Gemara basically says, because it's too hard, it's too long. But the Gemara says that Bilam has both. Parshas Bilam or Balak has both reference to Mitzrayim, as well as Kara, Shachav, Kari, Uchlevi, Miyakimenu. What makes that pasuk about the crouching lion so important? Oh, we should install Bilam because it has two things, Mitzrayim and the crouching lion. Was there a movie about 20 years ago, Crouching Tiger or Crouching Lion or something? So you want to have the movie, reference to the movie in Parsha Shema. So Rashi says, because it sounds a little parallel to Kriya Shema, the first parsha. In the first parsha, B'shach b'cha u'v'kumecha, when you go to sleep, when you wake up. So crouching lions, go to sleep, wake up, similar. But the Midrash has a different spin. This is a really beautiful Midrashim in Balak. I'm happy I chose to talk about it. You know a Midrashim. Hen am kalavi akum einu ma bolam kayotze b'hem. Again, this is Bilam learning Jewish history. He's learning, especially learning Chassidus. He's learning that the Baruch Hu loves his people, even coming to Chassid. He says, Harehim yesheni min ha-Tara, min ha-Mitzvos. They lost it all. They don't keep Torah. They don't keep mitzvos. There's some real evocation here, if you're following, of Shir HaShirim, Ani Yishena V'Livi Air. I'm asleep, but my heart still is connected to Hashem. And what happens? Ve'omdim mishnasam kerayos. And they just wake up like a lion, even though they seem to be sleeping. V'chotfen, lions sleep a lot. V'chotfen kriyashma, they grab kriyashma like a lion, v'amlich la'kadosh baruch, which means that, if you want to translate this into historical terminology, Jews They may not study Torah the way they should be. They fall asleep. They're sleeping in Torah. And I know a lot of you guys used to sleep during my shir. I won't mention any names here, but you know, sleeping during shir. And they don't perform mitzvahs the right way. Not everyone's orthodox. But they never walk away from Hashem. They're always mam lech Hashem. Shema Yisrael, one pasuk every Jew knows, Shema Yisrael, Hashem lekein, Hashem lechad, chofim, kriya shema. Namely, they still believe in me, they still mekabel malchus shemayim. They may not be such great tzaddikim. Like a lion sloughing its time, wakes up, grabs its meat, goes back to sleep. And again, Balaam is processing. Oh my goodness, Hashem should have cursed them. He doesn't. Oh my goodness, Hashem doesn't even see their faults. So he beat up to be a kovel, and mol be so. Oh my goodness. And Balaam realizes that this isn't going anywhere. This is futile. And his entire claim falls apart. That's what makes Balaam such a resonant historical parsha. We don't live through this so much anymore. But you can't imagine the struggle of living as a Jew through the Middle Ages and constantly, constantly living under the endless barrage that you are not God's chosen people. You're the children of the devil. And you know what? The world around you pretty much corroborated that, because Jews were on the decline and Christianity was on the rise, or Islam was on the rise, and where you lived. And you lived in a world that supported this declaiming, disclaiming, and this repudiation, and just to keep that faith. And a parsha like Balaam says, no, it's been said before, and the truth is, I'll end here because I don't take too long. That was basically Haman's gamble thousands of years later. Haman's basic gamble, one second there, I'll get you. Haman's basic gamble was, okay, but now it's even further down history. Now they forfeited the first base of Mikdash. So now they're really, really cast aside. That's why he tells Achashverosh, Yeshno Amachad, Mifuzar Mifarad Bein Amin. They're now just Bein Amin. Now, these are not fools. They study history. They know about Avraham. They know about Har Sinai. They know about the Nisim. They try to find a way to work their agenda into these historical narratives and still provide hope for their conquest. And so many of the ideas that Balaam mouths, it was Nevuah that Hashem basically delivers to us through Balaam. Essentially, Hashem is debunking Christianity and Islam through Balaam, the Gentile prophet. Before Christianity ever arises to lodge that claim, before Islam will ever arise to lodge that claim, Hashem says, by the way, your own prophet already asserted it, and it was debunked in his own term. I'm sorry, Ned, Nachi, want to ask something?
Why is he successful? Why is he successful with the Midianite women?
Okay, so keep it again. You're calling the Chazal's Medrash. We don't have him directing the Midianite women. Not a Balaam authored event. It's just Midianite women that happen to entice the Jewish people. He's not successful in halting the Jewish advance. He's successful in creating temptation when Jews fall into temptation. Again, it's temptation. It's consequence for temptation, but it's not a deal breaker. It doesn't break our relationship with Hashem, just like the ego doesn't break our relationship with Hashem. This recovery and this tshuva. But Hashem is still interested in the Jewish people, and the hero that arises, Pinchas arises. So it doesn't break the deal. It can lead to, in this case, casualties and loss. Okay? Nachum? Okay. So we'll stop here, and I'm happy everyone's caught up. I didn't know everyone's caught up, so it's nice to... And tomorrow is the barbecue, right? Tomorrow is the end of the year, long-distance barbecue, so we'll have to...